In 1976 in Fire Island, a restaurant on the Pine side of the island refused to serve a drag queen. She was from the Cherry Grove side, which at the time was a much more liberal and artistic place. And when her friends found out, a group of them decided to all get into drag and ride a water taxi over to the Pines as a sort of drag invasion. One of the original drag queens who was there in 76 was Bob Rose Levine. The Invasion, as it's called, is now an annual event where drag queens come in from all over to recreate this. It's really one of the most exciting days on the island, and Bob has continued to take part in it ever since. Bob first came to Fire Island in 1955, almost 70 years ago, and he has become a fixture of the island. I also think of him as something of a history keeper, since he's been a consistent presence for the island's many, many changes.
There was no electricity. There was no lights. You had candlelights. There was no fancy washing machines or showers. You had to pump the water if you wanted to take a shower. It was a place where you could hide away.
I got to speak to Bob this past summer at his home in Cherry Grove. And for those who don't know, Cherry Grove and the Pines, those are two parts of Fire Island. So you'll hear us say Cherry Grove, you'll hear us say Fire Island. Those are more or less the same place. They're not two separate islands. So just say heads up there. You're going to hear us talk about how the island has changed since the 50s, how it continues to change, how drag has changed. And Bob talks about why, despite growing up in the 30s and 40s, he never had to come out of the closet. I'm Jeffrey Masters, and this is LGBT Q&A with Bob Rose Levine. So to begin with, you've said that when it comes to like coming out of the closet, per se, you've never had to do that.
I never came out of the closet.
So that strikes me as incredibly rare for the time. Like, when were you born?
1933.
So in like the 30s and 40s, you never had to come out.
Well, I lived in New York City in the Bronx, and I went to school there. But when I was at a certain age, like 10, I got involved with the theater, and I went to movies. Then I went to Broadway on Saturday. And then I went during, after school, if I found there was something on Broadway that I wanted to see, I'd go to an evening performance and still come home and be in school in the morning.
Wow.
My mother and father let me do all that. And I never missed a movie that they had in the neighborhoods. So I used to go practically every day to a movie, and Saturday again I used to go to Broadway in the morning. Started the each week either the Paramount Theater, the Capitol, Radio City.
Were you going alone?
Yeah, and I loved it. And I used to tell them in my class, they wouldn't believe me because I was the only one in the class that had so much exposure to outside of the neighborhood. You know, they all stayed in the neighborhood. They played baseball or the stoop ball or whatever they did. And I did my own thing.
And what age range was that?
10, 11, 12, 15, you know.
So you're 12 years old going to a Broadway box office.
Exactly.
Paying how much money for a ticket?
$1.20.
Oh, my God.
And I saw My Fair Lady, South Pacific. I saw them on the first matinee, Annie Get Your Gun, with Ethel Merman.
Yeah.
My mother was also, she loved movies and theater. We were four boys in the family. And I used to be like the one to take care of making dinner, or my grandmother would come over and help us. But we had theater in our family.
Yeah. So were you like the quote unquote like gay brother of the four?
Yes, but I had two other gay brothers.
Oh my God.
Younger than me, yeah.
Three of four.
Three out of four. But see, I used to take them when they were old enough that my mother would say, well, take them to Broadway, take them to the movies. And they followed my lead.
Wow. And so your family had absolutely zero issue with your sexuality.
My mother and father were here on Fire Island, and they loved it. And they we never had a problem.
That's incredible. But I mean, in your like world and community, was that unusual or was that totally normal?
Well, I don't know, because I never had a problem with it, and other people might have, but they didn't. In those days, you didn't talk about it. And when I started to go to work, I always had a good job, and I bought the best clothes, and I had the best look. I had a big job for 14 years that I left, and then I went into my own business. I was a buyer for stores around the United States, and I had a buying office.
And so in New York City, like, were you going to, like where was, like, the center of gay life? Like, was it, like, the West Village back then?
Well, there was gay life all around, but mostly the Village. And then...
And were you going out there?
Yeah, I went to the Village at night. I mean, I went to gay bars. There were gay restaurants in the 50s, and there was Company, Country Cousins, other places in the Village. And if you want to go to a gay restaurant, it was filled with people. It was exciting. And today there's no gay restaurants. Every place is gay, straight. It doesn't matter anymore, you know.
Yeah.
But years ago, there was a little distinction of where you go, and the gay bars, there were many in New York, and you don't hear about them anymore as much, you know.
Yeah. Do you have, like, boyfriends during this time?
Yes, on and off. Yeah. But I have a partner now, 30 years. We're together. Yeah, he's taking a nap.
Sure. I could keep it quiet. I didn't know if you were, like, you know, 18 with, like, young love.
Yes and no. I didn't have a steady boyfriend. No. And then I came to Fire Island, and in those days, if you did drag, that was like, you know, you're out.
Bad.
So it was kind of quiet.
Yeah.
Because when I came to Fire Island, it was all executive men, mostly good looking from 30 to 50. Nobody was older. And it was a very high end. They lived in Cherry Grove.
That's where we're talking now, in Cherry Grove.
Yes.
Was back then, was the reputation that this was like the lesbian part of the island, or is that new?
In the 40s, it was straight. And somebody from the theater, I can't say somebody, but a group came out here, and there was no electricity. There was no lights. You had candlelights. There was no fancy washing machines or showers that you had to pump the water. It was a place where it was no telephones, no television. So it was a place where you could hide away. And in the 50s, a group from a theater came out here, and then they brought their friends. And in 1945, I should say, they opened the Arts Project. But the straight people that lived here rented to the gay people, and they fell right in with the fun. The gay people immediately brought in parties and excitement, because there was no Ice Palace. There wasn't Cherries or events. So they had a hat party on next Saturday, or a high heel party, or a cowboy party. Each week somebody had a party with a theme. And there were 25, 50, not more than 50 houses at that time. So everybody was invited. There was no telephones, nothing to do on a Saturday. That was the event.
And everyone just knows everyone's invited.
I don't think everybody was invited, but everybody knew, most everybody knew everybody to invite them.
Sure.
So if you had a party, you invited them. 2 weeks later, you have a party, you invite them back. And that's how it sort of started, with the parties. And there was the hotel where they had dancing, and they didn't allow men to dance. So there were women there, straight or gay women. They sort of got together where one woman would dance with two guys. So it was, you're not dancing, you're just in a circle or something. And that's how that got through. And then, and you said about lesbians. We always had lesbians here. There's always lesbians all over the world. It's not just something new. So they were here and they fit in with the gay guys. It was, there were more gay men than lesbians, but they were here. And then, of course, when we had the AIDS crisis in 1981, things changed. We used to have the Monster and the Sea Shack, and people would come from all over the island. There'd be a line from the ferry right to the restaurants. You couldn't get in. It was just so busy. And then the minute the New York Times had that article in the paper about AIDS, things stopped.
That was the, I think, like the 41 homosexuals has illness or something.
Yeah,
that line.
Yeah. That stopped, and it was like the faucet turned off, and we felt it. There were no people from outside of the community, and they thought they're going to catch it. Then the year after, the one place burnt down, and things changed, and then men died, and then the girls started to buy houses. We had girls here before, but they bought houses. And it was more prominent.
And just to clarify, are you saying that there was always gay and straight people on the island, but during like the AIDS crisis, they cleared out, and that's when the Fire Island became predominantly gay?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. The straight people always had, they always owned houses here. And we still have a lot of straight people that live here all summer because they enjoy the activity that we have to offer. And they don't have that kind of lifestyle. Wow. Neither do we. If you went to the mainland, what would you do? You don't have this kind of lifestyle, do you?
No.
It happened to you. But the traffic stopped.
Ah.
But a lot of people were dying each week. 5, 6, 8 people. It was terrible, terrible.
And you were out here every summer for that?
I missed a day out here.
I think you first came out in 1955.
Yes.
What was that first trip like?
Well, it was. It took 45 minutes on the boat. That's the first thing. We had one grocery store open. You brought food. It was, and we had a gas stove with a gas tank, and it was very basic. I remember. It became famous that people would make what they call fairy pudding. I haven't made it. I'm going to make it again. It's a tuna fish with cream mushroom soup,
okay. Peas.
It's like a pudding.
Okay.
And that was the dinner. Most everybody make fairy pudding. I have to bring it back.
Okay.
Not that it sounds, it's okay. It's tasty, but.
I mean, that's almost 70 years ago.
Yes.
Did you feel like a connection to this place like right away?
Yes, because when I came out here, I was invited by a friend, and he was already friendly with the group that gave the parties. And the minute I came out here, that night we went to a party, and we met people, and then they had shows out here, and I went to a show the next night, and I met the people at the cocktail party the night before. I said, they're in the shows. I want to be in a show. So I got into a show, and then I got involved in the community.
Oh, I see.
And that's how it started, you know.
And so you were performing. Did you start drag that first show? Like, when did that begin?
I was in drag, because most people were in drag, even the straight people. The husbands got in drag, and it was funny. It was frumpy drag. It wasn't glamour. And I didn't have a wig. I went to Woolworths, and I bought a skein of yarn, and I made a wig out of it. I borrowed an old drapery as a cape. I borrowed a pair of shoes, but you put it together, and it worked.
And that was the norm back then, DIY drag.
Oh yeah, that's the normal, yeah.
I mean, you're talking about doing drag like, in a show, but you also like do your own solo shows, and you've done those performances.
Well, that didn't happen until 1971.
Oh.
I performed at every show that they had from 1955 until 71, and then some, but I had a very good pianist, and he put the show together for me, and so I had my first solo show with six boys, but it was still my show, and it was great.
In that show, were you singing live at
yes,
that point?
Yes, I never sang. I never did a...
You've never lip-synced in your life?
Well, I did when but not, that's not my, I'm not known to lip sync.
No, you're a singer.
Yeah, I only lip synced maybe twice or three times when I was doing a duet with somebody else who didn't sing and we didn't have a pianist. But other than that, I do my own singing, yeah.
Amazing. And so 71, like what did your drag look like back then?
It was glamorous because I was a buyer and I had the taste and I didn't like frumpy drag. And I was already singing solos. So I had friends out here, they would do my hair, makeup. And I had designer friends who would say, I'll make you a dress. Or at that time, I was the buyer and the designers on 7th Avenue who came out here knew who I was. And they said to me, they came over to me in the showroom, do you need a dress for next Saturday night for your show? Oh, yes. So they made a dress. They gave me a sample. I was a little thinner then. I could fit into the sample size. Return it on Monday.
Oh, you're borrowing, like, fashion.
That's how Nancy Reagan started.
Oh, my God. You must have been, I mean, not to throw shade in the other girls, but you must have been like a leg and a whatever above everyone else with looks.
Absolutely. I have pictures I could show you. Yes. Yes.
Wow. And so what were some of those like songs you were singing in those solos?
Well, the first song I sang was Rose of Washington Square. See, all these posters are all old song sheets. So that's to let you all know, my living room walls on Fire Island, floor to ceiling, are all framed posters of old music sheets.
Yeah, I can read like a rose with a broken stem, yes. The red rose rag,
right.
Rose Sweet Rose, yeah. The rose of my heart.
So Martin Crabb gave me the song Rose of Washington Square, which is Fanny Bryce did. It's right up there behind the stack there. And he changed the words to Rose of Cherry Grove fame. And that's kind of my theme song of Fire Island. And it just
amazing.
Developed.
I've got those Broadway vampires lashed to a mast. I've got no future, but I want a past. I'm Rose of Washington Square. On Grant's lyrics, they call me Rose of Cherry Grove.
We didn't have lip sync, and we didn't have the stereo and the sound systems that they had. We didn't have the electronics, so when I started, you had to sing your own song or with a piano player or whatever. Those who performed, they would dress in a little frumpy drag, old lady wig, just kind of to be a drag. That was the style. Nobody was glamorous.
Yeah.
Like when the invasion started.
Yeah.
Everybody was in drag. They wanted to get in drag. But they came with a little house dress, an old wig. They didn't shave.
Yeah.
They wore a mustache.
I want to talk about the invasion. That was 1976 in July. Can you explain the origin story? It sounds like Terry Warren, a drag queen, went to the Pines and was not seated, right? When did you find out, like, about that?
Well, I don't know. I was a week later, within a week or so of the time that she was denied the entry, Pansy or somebody came to me and said, we're going to the Pines on a boat. It's a water taxi. And you want to go? Get dressed. Where to go? So I was writing a column. I still write the column for the Fire Island News. I started in 1973, still have my column. I wrote in that column that we invaded the Pines, and that's how the term started.
So you coined the term.
I coined the term.
Oh, I see. And so everyone, there's about 17 queens, I guess, rode over in that water taxi.
17, yes.
And so you arrive in the Pines. How were you treated?
When we got there, we didn't know how we would be treated, but we were all in drag on a boat, and it was tea dance, and they were screaming, and they couldn't not let us in because we walked in and everybody was welcoming us and screaming and whistling and...
And just to clarify, screaming in a good way, not
yes,
negative.
No, screaming
not negative.
In a good way. So then everybody was either buying us drinks or the bartenders offered us drinks. And we didn't stay long, but we stayed for probably an hour or less. We got on the boat and went back. So it was fun. And then we did it in the second year. And that's how that developed.
So you decided the next year, let's make this a tradition.
I didn't decide.
Someone did.
Pansy might have decided. But I was always part of the group, yes.
And Pansy's one of the other drag queens in Cherry Grove, who is also still alive.
Oh, yeah. She and I, the two, Lynn Hutton, there are three still alive, but Pansy and I still live on the island.
We've often heard about, like, the many, like, police raids of gay bars in the city, but they also did police raids here, right?
Well, in the 60s, 1961, 2, 3, 4, 5, yeah. In the 4 or 5 years of the early 60s, there were raids, and they'd have policemen come out here in plain clothes, and they were young, and they looked like they were gay guys, so nobody knew they were policemen, and I was never involved, thank God, And I used to go to, I had to go to theater to Jewish rehearse or, and if I had, I had a guest here once and we had dinner. I told him I'd meet him at 2 a.m. because that's when the rehearsal was over.
That's
I waited and he never showed up, but he was arrested. He walked outside and on the walk, someone's cruising him. And if you touch the guard, they arrest you. So that's what happened.
And the person cruising him was a police officer.
Police officer. And they took, so they had many, they took them off, not one by one. They'd have 10 of them. They'd grab you and they'd have a boat waiting or taking them over all together. They go to the police station and we didn't have telephones then. And my friend called, I don't know how we got the telephone. There was a telephone booth down in town, in center of town. And he called the telephone booth, somebody answered, and he asked for me. The receiver was hanging until I got there. They went here, got me, I went back. So I went to the, where are you? He's in jail. Now, he needed $1,000.
Wow.
To bail himself out. I don't know how I got it. In a minute, I worked it out. We had to send $1,000 to the jail house. And so this was on a Friday. Saturday morning, he called me. And then I remember that I was in the show on Saturday night. We used to do 3 shows on that. One night, 9, 11, and 1. So about 9:30, the boat came in. It was just the break of the 2 shows, you know, intermission of the, it was the end of the first show. And I had a half hour or so, picked him up at the boat and I had to go back. But yes, they came back if you gave them $1,000 bail. So I, my friend...
That's a lot of money now, alone then.
Well, the $1,000, I don't think they ever got it back. And then they had to get a lawyer. He lived in Florida. And this went on for 3 or 4 years. He had to come back to New York for a court case. It must have cost him $10,000 in those days. Lawyers, traveling, never got the money back, of course.
Yeah.
And it was all a scam for the people to make money. And but it stopped. And then a lot of people...
Did it stop for a reason?
I don't know the reason, I mean, but it stopped.
Okay.
And the people who were arrested, who lived here, most of them were executive men, and they took their names and addresses where they worked, and they were fired or...
Because they often printed them in the paper.
They printed in the New York Times and the Post and News. Now, I bought my house from one of those guys that was, had he was in his late 50s. He had a big job with U.S. Steel. He was arrested, put in the paper, the name, fired. At that age, in those days, you couldn't get a job anymore. There was no internet. He had to move to St. Thomas, and I bought the house.
Wow. Yeah,
it was different.
What year was that?
65.
Wow. So you've been in this house that we're in right now since then?
58 years.
God. So since you've like retired from like your job in fashion as a buyer.
I'm busier than
really
in show business.
But you're a full-time drag queen now.
I'm not saying a drag queen. I'm a performer.
Performer.
Yeah.
Okay, because again, like the changes into drag, like when you started in the 70s, like being a drag queen as a career wasn't really a possibility.
No.
What is the distinction for you, the drag performer versus like drag queen?
Well, I'm not a drag. I don't go anywhere in drag except if it's a special event or for a show or whatever. I don't.
If they're paying,
just get no. Oh. But I don't get paid.
Oh,
a lot of stuff. I do all this for nothing. I don't.
Like the show that was a couple of weeks ago here. Like that was just for the like fundraiser for the community.
Fundraiser for
the,
they get that my show sells out.
Yeah,
you were there.
Yeah. I went last year. I couldn't get a ticket this year.
Oh my god. Well, when they put my name up, they sell tickets, and they make enough money to pay the rent for the season.
Wow.
So, yeah, I don't get paid.
Oh, amazing. I mean, you're 90 years old.
Yeah.
Do you worry about, like, when you, like, one day can't come out here?
No, because I'm not going to, I'm not worried about it. I'm still going. I'm lucky that nobody, that my age, people my age are... not doing what I do, you know.
Not at all. Yeah. I think this was fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you for spending so much time.
Well, thank you.
Just turn me loose in Cherry Grove under an island moon. Keep me right here on this island that's gay, where everyone here is a little that way. Give me a stage and spotlight where I can sing and dance. Give me a script with a musical theme and you'll see a show starring Rose Lavigne.
And that is Bob Rose Lavigne, who, if you're lucky and in Cherry Grove this summer, I promise, you definitely want to go hear her sing live. Then next week, we're back with Mia Yamamoto. She was born in 1943 in a Japanese internment camp in Arizona during the war, and she is still a practicing criminal defense attorney in Los Angeles.
When I was working in the juvenile court, I remember representing trans kids, and I remember looking at them and thinking, they got kicked out of their house when they were like 12, 13, because the parents didn't like the way they dressed. It's just so tragic and so sad. And these kids are so brave. The thing that struck me was these kids are coming out 13, 14 years old, something I had absolutely no way that I would have ever been able to do. That I would have mustered the courage to stand up and say, I want to wear a dress. And I don't care what happens.
That's Mia Yamamoto, and that will be coming out next week. And then, as always, if you enjoyed the show, please help us to spread the word by posting about us on social media and or by texting 1 or 2 or 10 of your friends about the show. It truly is one of the biggest and best ways to help us grow. And if you do that, come and tag us. We're on social media at LGBTQPod. I'm also on there at JeffMasters1. Thank you so much to everyone who has been doing that. And also thank you to everyone who has signed up for our Substack. We are an independently produced podcast, and we really could not make the show without your support. So if you want to and are able to help support our show, joining our Substack is the best way to do that. So there is a link in our show notes to that. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much to everyone who has joined us there. All right, I'm Jeffrey Masters. I will see you next week.